Sorry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Rachel. I'm so flattered that so many of you came to hear me talk when you didn't have to. Amazing. Well, you were kind enough to provide me with some questions to kind of respond to in my talk, and that was really great to get these kind of structure my talk around. And then I kind of also realized that it's kind of bad because now I have to answer these questions, and some of them are kind of hard, like, I don't know. So, you know, I'm going to do my best. And really, I have prepared a very short talk because I figure we can just have a conversation. I mean, you can ask me what you want to ask me. Okay. So the questions that I had from you kind of fell into two categories. One was the kind of what is your story and how can I apply that story to helping me get a job, basically. That's how I read them, which is good. And then sort of technical, kind of future trend type questions, like what are the technologies that are going to matter and what is going to be the impact of Google Scholar and those kinds of questions. Those are the hard questions for me. So, I'm going to do the easy part first and then try to tackle the hard part second. So my story, I figured I'll just kind of, I've met most of you and told you some version of like how I ended up as a librarian and like what my path through my career so far has been, but I guess I'll just kind of go through that really quickly so you can see how completely kind of unplanned all of it has been, which I think is sort of comforting, right? When you're a student, you can kind of see, you know, you see people that are working in the profession, it seems like, oh, they must have like had their act together from the very beginning and had this whole course planned out, but, you know, most of us haven't. My undergraduate degree was in biology, and I wanted to work with animals and go outside and look at critters. And I did that after I graduated. I had a couple of really great field research jobs that I loved. And then it kind of dawned on me that, like, in order to kind of keep working in that field, I was really going to need and ever make any more money than, like, intern stipend, which I needed to because I had student loans. I was going to need to get a PhD and really like be a biology professor, which wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to hang out with critters outside. So I kind of thought, well, that's not what I'm going to do. I don't want to teach biology. I might want to teach something, but it's not biology. I don't want to specialize like that. So I worked in my college library for 4 years that I was there. So I was kind of looking around for some job to have if I wasn't going to be a biologist, and got a job in the circulation department at one of Dartmouth's libraries. And it was kind of the same sort of stuff I've been doing as a student assistant. Just worked in that library, and I enjoyed being in the library setting, as I had for those 4 years that I was in the library in college, but didn't think at all about being a librarian. Honestly, a lot of the librarians I knew, I thought, you know, I've worked with them for years. I thought they were, like, boring. I don't know. I just thought, that job will just drive you crazy. You're just trying to, like, put order on the universe, and it's impossible. So, of course, you're just going to get bitter. That was my perspective on librarians. Right? So even though I've worked in libraries for, like, 6 years, I still don't really have any real idea about, like, what librarians did or what the profession really was. This band that I really liked, the singer needed a nanny to watch her kids while she toured. So I packed up all my stuff and I left the library and I went on tour and traveled around the world with this family for like 7 months, and that was fabulous. And then they weren't on tour anymore and they didn't need a nanny, because when she's not on tour, she's basically hanging out at home with kids, so she didn't need a nanny anymore. So I was kind of like, now what do? You know, I'm not a biologist. I'm not going to be a rock and roll nanny for the rest of my life. I didn't really like it. It was really hard being on tour. It's not as glamorous as I thought it would be. I loved the family, but the sort of tour lifestyle was, you know, not something I wanted to continue to do. And so I was flailing around for something to do and sort of applying for some library jobs because that's what I knew how to do. And then I had a bunch of friends, so this was like 1996, maybe 97. So the web was just starting to exist. And I had a bunch of friends that had kind of started a web company right out of college. It was like 1996. They started a company like making websites for companies, and they did like the L.L. Bean website and a few other first kind of e-commerce sites. And they said, well, we can get you a job at our company building websites. And I said, the first time I ever like used a computer was in that job at Dartmouth. I don't know anything about building websites. And I said, it doesn't really matter, because basically at that time they just needed people, nobody knew anything about building websites, so they just needed people who were willing to do it and learn and who were smart. And I was those things. I was like desperate for some food. But I really did not want it to be my career. I was working for this company. We made websites for like Fortune 50 companies. So making websites like American Express and AT&T, and going on business trips and going to these office parks in New Jersey. And like, I hated every minute of it, you know. I liked writing code, but I just really didn't like being in the business world at all. I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do, and I didn't feel good about using my talents to like sell stuff. It just felt gross to me, so I didn't want to do it. So it's like, well, I'm going to do this for 6 months, you know, while I get back on my feet after this nanny thing and figure out what I'm doing next, because I had no idea what I'm doing next. And then, you know, time went by, and I was still doing it. And so I kind of had this realization around the time when I moved here, which was around 2000. So it's like 99, 2000 when I decided, okay, I've been doing this for like 3 years, 4 years, and if I don't stop doing it, it's going to be what I do. And that's not what I want, so I need to do something else. And I thought, well, I'll become a veterinarian because I really want to work with animals. And then I found out how hard it is to get into vet school, and was told by several vet schools, like, basically you're going to have to get a whole new undergraduate degree, because even though you have a biology degree, it wasn't the right biology degree. And I said, oh, I don't want to be a vet that bad. So I just sat down and made a list of all the things that were really important to me and that I wanted to do out of the work that I did. And I wanted to help people. I wanted to protect people's access to information. You know, I cared about civil liberties. And then on the other side, I made a list of like jobs that I'd had. And then a third column that was like jobs that I would be able to explore these things in this first column. And so I had kind of that list, and then, you know, working in a library, being a nanny, being a scientist, being a waitress, you know. And then over here, I kind of had lawyer, ? And then I had my appeal, and what could it be that, like, I could do these things, work with people and help them, protect civil liberties, what could it be? And then I was like, librarian. And I got on the web and started kind of, like, exploring. You know, by this time there were all these library blogs, you know, and I found Jessamyn West's blog, and I'm like, oh my god, there are radical, like, anarchist librarians. Oh my god, I had no idea, I thought they were boring people. And so then, like, 3 months later, I was in library school. So, I mean, I just do stuff. And, but it turned out to be the best decision I could have made, because I've been in the profession for you know, years longer than I was in any of my other kind of my other kind of paths, and I don't see myself leaving it because there's so much ability to do so many different kinds of things, and because it is really satisfying all of those things that were on that list of things that really mattered to me. And I found that the librarians are actually really interesting, awesome people, and I get to spend my time with those people, so what could be better? After library school, well, while I was in library school, I did a practicum at Washington State University, Vancouver, and that was another really good decision. And I had not intended to do a practicum. I didn't want to do a practicum because I was working a full-time job and, you know, going to school, and I had another side business on the side doing this website thing still. and, you know, I still had hobbies and wanted to have some kind of life, so I was just, like, really not that interested in doing a practicum. But Karen Diller asked me, would you like to do a practicum with us? And I thought, well, I'm not going to say no to things, opportunities that come up. Sure, I'll do a practicum with you, whatever. That'll be great. And it was great, and I loved it there. And then after my practicum ended, they had a temporary position available, so took the temporary position. And then the temporary position turned into a permanent position, and I interviewed for that position and got that position. So again, not a lot of intention there. You know, I didn't even think I was going to be an academic librarian because I really felt like those kind of access to information issues were playing out in the public library sphere a lot more vitally than they were in academic libraries. But I was working in a public library and doing my practicum in an academic library, and felt that my interests beyond those sort of access to information issues were more fully engaged in the academic library for now. So lo and behold, I found that, oh, I actually do want to be an academic librarian. And then I was totally happy in that job. I loved that job, loved my coworkers, loved everything about it except the commute. I saw the ad for the position, the electronic resources librarian position at Reed came up, and I thought, I can't apply for that. I love my job. Why would I apply for a job? And then I thought, something about that seems right. I'm going to apply for it. And now I work at Reed. Again, not a lot of intention there, but it was, I've been there since January 2nd, and it was clear to me it was a very great decision, not only because my commute is now 3 miles, which is so great. I go home for lunch sometimes. But also, it's just like a really, there's a lot of new responsibilities in my new job. A lot of, because WSU Vancouver is a commuter campus, a lot of the kind of mechanics of running a library happened in Pullman. You know, so we were really serving our campus, but everything that had to do really with kind of cataloging and kind of, well, just any kind of big decisions for the library happened in Pullman, and we're really removed from that, which was kind of great as a way to start my career. And in a lot of ways, I'm finding now, even though I've only been at Reed for 3 weeks, really great in a lot of other ways too, because you could just kind of like call Pullman and say, oh, you know, this thing isn't working, make it work, you know. And it didn't really fall to us to make everything work. When you're not a branch campus, it turns out, you know, you have to make everything work, which is really fun. So the question, one of your questions was, what are my responsibilities at Reed? I don't really know yet. I've been there just since January 2nd, and you know, electronic resources librarian, a lot of our titles, they don't really like mean that much, and they mean really different things at different institutions. And Reed was very clear with me that they didn't really want to be very prescriptive about what it meant to be the electronic resources librarian at Reed. They didn't want to just kind of tell me what my predecessor had done and have me do that. My predecessor did a great job, but they wanted me to kind of take it and run with it. So, which is fantastic, but also kind of scary, because I don't really know everything about what it is to be an electronic resources librarian. I mean, I'm in there and I'm having to, you know, work with the catalog and, you know, get these records in the ERM module, and I've never worked with any of that before at all. You know, at WSU, I just did, you know, reference and instruction, and I didn't buy books, I never had my hands, I never got into Millennium, into the ILS, and touched any records. I just wasn't involved with that. So now I find myself not only involved with it, but responsible for it, and nobody there knows how to tell me how to do it, because, you know, none of them have done it. The person who did my job before me did it. So it's just so exciting to have this whole new set of responsibilities and be scared and have no idea how to do them. And, you know, it's great. And to leave my office and get totally lost every time I leave, because the Reed Library is really confusing. You know, I just I thought I had it under control, and I went down a staircase that I hadn't gone down before. It's like, I have no idea where I am. I thought it was going to be in government documents, but I don't even know where government documents is from here. So, yeah, that's challenging, but really exciting. And at WSU, we had 20,000 print volumes. And there's something like 20,000 print volumes in the reference collection alone at Reed. So I'm going to have to learn a whole new way of doing reference and a whole new way of teaching with a big collection and all that. So it's really exciting. So, you know, what can you learn from my story? Well, you know, and this is where I have to give advice, and I don't know. I mean, a lot of it's just personality. You're going to, like, do well in your careers by being most fully yourselves. I mean, one of the questions was, what do I do to get an edge in the job market? Well, it depends on what kind of job you want, right? I mean, if you want to be a reference librarian, what you do is kind of different than what you want to what you do if you want to be a systems librarian, which is different than what you do if you want to be a children's librarian. I couldn't possibly speak to those things. I have no idea. But one thing you can all do is, you know, be yourselves and say yes to opportunities. Say yes and yes and yes and yes and yes to everything that comes up. And not in a give me work to do, but, like, I think a lot of us, a lot of librarians that I know, you know, we're modest people. Well, I'm not, but a lot of librarians are, you know, modest people, and we tend to, like, underestimate ourselves, and, you know, so people will kind of, you'll see an opportunity, and you'll think, well, that opportunity isn't for me. Like, I'm not, I couldn't give that conference presentation, because I'm not, I don't give conference presentations. I don't know, I'm just a student, or I don't write for a journal. I don't know how to do that. Well, the only way you're going to do that is just to say yes. I'm going to, it terrifies the heck out of me, and I'm just going to do it. You know, I'm scared to death of giving a conference presentation, so I'm going to give a conference presentation. And, you know, my first conference presentation was when I started at WSU. I'd been there 2 weeks in my temporary position, and Karen came to me and she said, you know, one thing that would make it really a lot easier for you to get the permanent position when it comes open is if you started to do conference presentations and write papers. And I was crippled by the idea of doing a conference presentation. I mean, it just made me sick to my stomach. I was so nervous just even thinking about it. And she said, and there's a deadline coming for Online Northwest, and it's tomorrow, and I think that you should write a proposal to do a talk about something. I've been in this job for 2 weeks. I've been a librarian for 2 months. You know? What am I going to even propose? I don't know what to propose, and I stayed up all night. I couldn't sleep. I was sick to my stomach. And I said, well, I'm really interested in copyright, and I've been kind of looking into Creative Commons, so I'll propose to do a talk about Creative Commons, and it's not going to get accepted because it's totally not appropriate for that conference, and they won't accept it, and I won't have to do it. And then it got accepted, and I couldn't sleep, and I was nervous, and I was like, but they shouldn't have accepted it. It was a terrible proposal, you know? I wrote it overnight. I didn't think it would get accepted. And then I gave the talk, and it was awesome, and I found out that I really like giving conference presentations. And I was like, so nervous before I gave it. I couldn't. And then as soon as I was talking, I felt great. And then I've done all this talking, you know, people are always like, how did you, you know, how do you get out there and do all these conference presentations? What do I need to do that? Well, just do it. You know, if my proposal that was totally inappropriate for that conference, I mean, it was not a technology topic. There's no reason in the world that presentation should have been accepted. I mean, and I was nobody, you know, I'd been a librarian for 2 months. They shouldn't have accepted it, but they did, right? And they'll accept yours. And then you'll go and you'll give the talk and it'll be scary, but then people will know you. And that fundamentally is what is true of all of, you know, whether you're gonna be a systems librarian or a reference librarian or a children's librarian, the one thing you can do to get ahead in the job market is make sure that the people that you're interviewing with, like, recognize your name when your resume comes across their desk. Because it's a small profession, it's a very, very social profession. And, you know, when we do job hunts, we get 150 applications and they all start to look the same. And so whether or not you want it to be true, recognizing the name on the application, oh, I saw her get this great conference presentation, or oh, he shot me an email after that conference presentation that I did and said that he really liked it. And then we had this interesting conversation about the topic of my conference presentation, or oh, you know, I read their little article in the OLA Quarterly. Yeah, I recognize that name. They must be somebody that really cares about libraries and really cares about the profession, because I know who they are, right? And that it's not even really ethical reasoning, right? Because people whose names you don't know also care about the profession, are also great librarians, but it does make the difference when people know you. So, and that's something that everybody can do, right? And how you do that really is going to depend on your personality. When I was in library school, and everybody would say, you have to go to the conferences and network. I mean, believe it or not, I'm a pretty shy person. Like, when I know people, I'm not shy at all, and I don't fear public speaking, but like social situations, like where you're supposed to network, I just want to go and find one person that I know and talk to them, and I just don't like that at all. It is not my place to thrive. So I'd go to these conferences and sort of awkwardly feel like, oh, there's the director of that library, I should go and say something to them, and I don't know what it would be. And I would see other people do it, you know, that is something that they're good at, you know, and they would go and they would say, oh, hey, I hear you guys just switched to this new software, tell me all about it. And then they'd be in this small talk conversation with somebody, and I would think, why can't I do that? Well, I can't do that, so I don't even try. That's not how I got to know people. You know, I got to know people in that one-on-one way that's comfortable for me. So maybe when somebody gave a talk at a conference that I really liked, I would send them an email afterwards and just say, hey, I really thought that was interesting. You know, can we talk more about that? Or just walk up to them afterwards. You know, so you don't have to do the kind of networking thing. If it doesn't work for you, it's not going to work for you. But you do have to get out there and have people kind of know who you are. So yes, opportunities, and talk to people. What else can I say? This is sort of a personality thing too, but I think one thing you can do to like give yourself an edge is to really, really be interested in everything. I mean, if I think about things that have made me successful, it's a lot of times that I'm a real generalist, and I'm really sincerely interested in everything in the world, and I just take in a lot of information, and it helps me make connections that people who are less interested in the world don't make, and so then it's really easy to have conversations with a lot of different kinds of people about their work, and I'm actually like really interested in what they do and what they have to say, and I have something that I can bring to it because I've been reading about it, and I don't really know how to tell you how to do that. I mean, I think some of that is just sort of a personality thing, but I read a lot of stuff in our profession. You know, I read a lot of librarian blogs and a lot of librarian journals, but I also read a lot outside of the discipline, and I think that that is, I don't know, it just keeps me engaged in a way that just reading within the profession I don't think would, and I just feel like it helps me understand the library issues in a way that I wouldn't if I didn't, if I just read what other librarians were saying. So, you know, just keep your interests broad. Like, if you come from some disciplinary background, you know, keep reading in that area. Or, like, if you find, like, you're interested in a particular topic in librarianship, there's probably people in other disciplines that are doing work like that, you know. So, like, I'm interested in copyright. Well, I read, like, a lot of read like law journals and lawyers' blogs, and I read like computer programmers' blogs and some of their publications, and then there are some like cultural studies professors that do that kind of stuff, and I read all of that stuff, and I think that it makes me kind of better at being a librarian, and it makes me better in my job interview because I'm able to kind of like bring in all this stuff, so. And just when you're a passionate person, you're more interesting. So, you know, don't feel like you have to. I think sometimes like there's so much to take in the profession. You know, so much of our professional literature. I mean, we write and we write and we write and we talk and we talk and we talk. It can feel like you can't even take all of that in, let alone like look outside of the discipline. And so I think it can I don't know, that pressure of all of our disciplinary stuff on us can kind of like deaden our interest in the outside stuff. And I would just say, like, always don't get sucked into that too much. Like, always keep your fresh perspective and keep outside of the profession. Because that's what lets you kind of have fresh ideas. And, you know, help people out. I mean, and follow through when you say that you're going to. I laugh because I just like took a really long time responding to an email. Like, always follow through when you say you'll do something. but that is one thing, like, a lot of professional librarians are really busy in their jobs, and they, I don't know, they have like the day-to-day of their work, and so then you're like on a committee with them or something, and then also they're on all these horrible committees, and the committees never get anything done. I mean, ALA, committee work in general, you know, you just go on and nothing ever happens, and everybody says, oh yeah, we're going to do all these great things, and you go to the meeting, and you're really excited about the things you're going to do that are going to change the profession, and then you get back to your jobs, and nobody ever does the things that you talk about in the meeting. Well, if you do the thing that you talk about at the meeting, you'll be like different than, you know, 98% of the people that sit in those committee meetings, and you will be noticed, and you'll be somebody that gets stuff done, and that is a really treasured thing. So when you do go and get on committees, which you do it, you know, it's good, especially like local, like OLA or whatever, or the local SLA. It's a great way to kind of have people know you, and you do some work together on a committee, and you actually go and do the thing that you talk about doing in that committee meeting, people are gonna think of you as somebody that gets stuff done. And it'll be extremely frustrating a lot of times because you'll be the only one that does it, and then the whole project doesn't really go where you thought it was gonna go, but at least, you know, you did your your part and got a good name for yourself. And so that's, I think, going to be the end of my prepared comments about advice. So on to the kind of harder prognostication stuff, which is really, really hard for me. I'm like the worst person in the world at predicting the future, and so I think because I talk a lot about technology topics and stuff, people kind of, I mean, one thing people really want to know, we all want to know the future. What are the top technologies that are going to affect libraries in the future? Like, and if I tell you one, you can pretty much bank on it not being the one that, so, you know, take all of this with a grain of salt. But I guess what I would say about, so the question, the specific question was, you know, what cutting edge technologies do you think are gonna affect the library world in the near future? And, you know, I don't really know. I know that some of the technologies that are affecting libraries now, they aren't really even technologies. I mean, all that Web 2.0 stuff, the blogs and the wikis and the podcasts and all of that stuff, it isn't really technology per se. You know, a blog is really just a website, right? But there's like a tool that lets you publish to it easily. You know, and a wiki is just a website. So I guess one piece of wisdom that I'm trying to spread is that we as librarians, I think, are more powerful when we don't think of all of that stuff as technology and then kind of just put it in the technology people's court and say, I'm not a techie, so I don't really need to know about this stuff or I don't understand it. Because, I mean, a lot of why that stuff is so important and why it's so important to libraries is because it's like this new way of producing, disseminating, organizing information. And hey, that's what we do. I mean, we're information people. Those are our concerns since the beginning of our profession. You know, how is information organized and how does that affect learning? How does that affect, you know, our ability to, you know, function as citizens? And a lot of these things that we put in the technology bucket, you know, that get talked about at technology conferences, you know, why they're important isn't because of like whatever, you know, PHP and Java and whatever like programming language and database is behind the scenes. We don't really care about that. We don't have to care about that. I mean, why they're interesting is because they're this new way of dealing with information. And that is our stuff, regardless of whether we're techies. So I would say when we think about like the cutting edge technologies that are going to affect libraries, be really careful about trying to tease out what's technology and what's our stuff, you know? what's information, what's content, what's, you know, what are the non-technical elements of these things that come kind of dressed in technology clothes to us, you know, that we can kind of think first that they're technology, but really when you kind of think about it for a minute, you realize that it's not really technology that makes that interesting. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that, right? Things, because technology is driving so much of the world now, and so much of our information is on the web, and there's innovations that are happening there. I think it'll be a lot less clear about what's technology and what's our stuff. You know, a book is clearly not something that we think of as in the realm of the techies, but we're dealing a lot less with like a book than we did. So that is my deft way of avoiding the question of what technologies are going to affect us in the future, because I don't know, and I don't know what the new technologies are. I mean, and I don't really, like, I guess the ebook readers, you know, probably somebody should pay attention to that. I'm not really interested in gadgets like that, and so I've been paying shamefully little attention to it. So yeah, I mean, I guess there's probably some technologies that are out there looming, but I'm just really bad at the future, so I don't know. That is maybe for another speaker. And then the other two questions I think that fell in this category, I think kind of go together in some ways, and that was, you know, what do you think the impact of Google Scholar will be in libraries, and what are libraries doing about the high cost of materials from publishers like Elsevier? And here's where I will talk about the future a little bit, because I guess because it doesn't have so much to do with technology, I feel more comfortable about it. But Google Scholar right now, and I'm going to include Google Books with Google Scholar, so this sort of new attempt by Google and others to provide kind of full text searching access to materials that we used to have only, you know, access to at the kind of subject level, right, on the open web. One thing that it's doing is strangely driving a lot of demand for materials that used to be really low demand. So like we would have an old book that nobody really cared about it or discovered, right? But now they can do a full text search in Google and find it in Google Books. And of course, a lot of what's in Google Books is out of copyright stuff, public domain stuff. So it's old stuff that's kind of been sitting on our shelves or in our storage units, in our storage facilities, and suddenly people want it, and they didn't want it because they weren't finding it. And that is, I think, kind of a, in some ways, an unexpected result of Google Scholar and Google Books, right, driving demand for musty old materials. And I think that the challenge that Google Scholar and Google Books presents to us, and there are several challenges, but one of them, right, is kind of thinking about how we use the kind of structured access to information that libraries offer, contextualized access to information, and the sort of really powerful full text searching of books. How do we make those complementary? And how do we convince people of the pleasures of contextualized information? I think we spend a lot of time wanting to convince people of the utility of organized information. Like, it's so much easier to actually find stuff when you use subject searching. Well, people are finding stuff. So, I mean, I think we're going to be barking up the wrong tree as we try to convince the public of the utility of using subject headings, right? Of using the sort of wonderful, structured, contextualized information that we have. We know that it's useful. We know that it's actually, in many cases, like, a more effective and quicker and nicer way to access information. But I think what we need to focus on are those pleasures of contextualized information, the pleasure of browsing, the pleasure of seeing like things next to one another and like because of what they're about, not because of the words that they share in common. Mm-hmm. And we don't spend any time really talking to people about that pleasure. And when people are searching, you know, searching now on the web, I mean, it is in some ways a pleasure activity, right? That the pleasure of discovering things. And so I think if we think more about what we have in our great structured information as offering, you know, something really nice for people, this ability to kind of make sense of their topic, we're offering them something a lot better than just trying to kind of beat them over the head with, it's better, you know, it's nicer, I think is maybe a better way for us to talk about it. So I think that is a challenge that these sort of digitization projects put in our lap. And I think that response of kind of trying to convince people of the pleasures of context is a response.
Well, that puts me in mind, you know, people who are familiar with the current catalog, that's what they liked about it.
Yeah.
They just get in the vicinity and then they can do the browsing. And so that's the analogy I use for people when they're saying they miss that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I liked about it. I mean,
just bumped into all kinds of great stuff.
And I think that there is increasing hunger out there among people for context and for sort of creating categories of information. You know, we see it with people really loving to use Delicious and Flickr and all of that. What is that except trying to like give some sort of sense to a world of, you know, keywords, of full text, of just information. So one of the ways that we need to change in order to convince people of this pleasure is to actually make it more pleasurable. And right now our catalogs are really, really unpleasurable. Like, they don't really offer anything good to our patrons, and they offer a lot of really bad things to our patrons, right? Like, I don't like to use library catalogs at all. And they're really expensive and they don't really offer us what we need in terms of being able to kind of take all the different kinds of data that we have access to and mash them together in useful ways. So if I would have a call for the future, so this isn't a prediction for the future, but if I had like my wish for the future, if I would leave you with one thing that I hope that we do, and that is kind of throw out the big commercial ILS and come up with a really viable open source catalog that does everything that we want it to do, and spend that money on employing really talented programmer librarians instead of spending that money on a big bloated piece of software that doesn't do what we need and doesn't do what our patrons need. And so that would be kind of my, and I think that that's not going to happen, probably. I'm saying that because, like, whatever I say, the opposite happens. I really am pessimistic about it happening, which, you know, maybe that should give you hope, but but I think that's what we really need. Like, we're gonna convince people of the pleasures of what we have to offer them in our collections. And really, if we're gonna just, I don't know, our catalogs are bad, basically.
I feel like, amen. I really that same solution, and I guess that's something that I'm struggling with is, I feel like, oh, I wanna write all these papers about this, I wanna talk to people, but then whenever I talk to people who are older or more embedded in the profession, they're like, eh, no.
Well,
it's very frustrating to me.
Has anybody ever worked at a library when you've gone through, like, you've switched ILSs? It's a horrible, I mean, yeah?
It's really awful.
Yeah. You'd rather keep working with the piece of junk software that you had than whatever this new thing is going to be.
It was really bad.
Because your whole organization, I mean, especially a big library, the whole organization is built, I mean, it's called an ILS, an integrated library system. I mean, everything that we do in our operation relies on this piece of software. So it's not like just learning a new catalog, right? It's like all of the book buying, all the acquisitions, all the cataloging, all that stuff, it all depends on this piece of software. So I mean, it's a pretty big gamble to switch to any new ILS and then to say, well, we're gonna go to this open source thing that's not actually supported by anybody. you know, and we're going to hire people and we're going to kind of trust that this thing is going to work because these young whippersnappers tell us that it will, you know. I don't blame people. I mean, if I was a library director, I would have a really hard time making the decision to change ILSs because it's costly in every way that something can be costly. It's costly in dollars, and it's costly in man hours, and it's costly in terms of your employees' sanity. I mean, it's a really bad experience to go through that. Yeah.
Well, along those same lines, I just started working in an elementary school library, and they just changed a whole new system. And so now all of the district computers can do interlibrary loan with all the different schools, which is new. So they had to re-inventory everything. Everything was a huge change. Well, it's still extremely frustrating. The search still sucks.
Right.
And we're teaching the kids, though, because so they get to find out now in elementary school that that it's really difficult and it doesn't work really well, so that they know when they go to the public library, it's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
We're teaching them that skill of how to handle their frustration.
Exactly. And I think that's what we do, right? Because we feel like we're saddled with these information retrieval systems that don't work really well. So what we do in all of our VIs and all the time, I mean, or with our patrons in the public library or with our elementary school kids, is we teach them how to like deal with the frustrations of the system and get what they want, even though the system doesn't work real well. And, you know, that is pretty far from pleasure. So I think, yeah. and I have no solution because, I mean, we do need to teach them how to deal with the shortcomings of our system if they want to get access to our collection. I guess now that'll be the end of my prepared remarks. Yeah.
I had a question. There's several of us that are interested in academic librarianship, and I'm wondering if you could be a generalist in an academic library, or if you have to have this sort of specialized.
I would say
area.
You absolutely can be a generalist in an academic library. You're probably going to have some set of responsibilities, like in addition to your. So yeah, like at Reed, I am the electronic resources librarian, and Jack down the hall is the acquisitions librarian, and Marcia's the cataloger, and you know she does a lot of catalog. I mean that's pretty specialized, but really we all teach, we all do reference. We're all kind of generalists, but then somebody has to be responsible for each of the little functional areas of the library, so somebody takes that on and does that. But we all kind of are generalists. We all know everything that's kind of going on in the whole library. We're a small library, and it was the same at WSU Vancouver, a small library. You know, I was the reference coordinator, and Nicole was the electronic resources coordinator, and Nicholas was the instruction coordinator, but we really all did the same kinds of stuff. We're all really very much generalists. I mean, any one of us could probably step into the other one's role and do at least like the basics of what they did, and then, you know, we might need them to do the person that had responsibility for it to do the, you know, make the decisions or do the more technical side of it. But yeah, I think you absolutely can be a generalist. But I think it's harder to be a generalist in a big academic library. Like my colleagues that work at, you know, OSU or WSU Pullman, you know, they're much more specialized in the work that they do, and the roles are a lot more clearly defined, and there's, you know, departments within the library. I mean, there's no departments within any of the libraries that I've worked in, so everybody's really been very generalist. So it really depends on the library, but yeah, it's very possible. You'll probably have to have some area of specialization, and honestly, you'll probably want one, because those that, like, 9 months or whatever when I was just a temporary reference librarian. I was just reference librarian. I didn't have like an area that I was responsible for. It was really miserable. I mean, I liked working there, but I didn't have anything that was mine to do that like helped the library. You know, I couldn't have my vision be executed, you know, in the library. I just kind of did what other people asked me to do. So, I mean, really you'll probably find that you want some area that's like yours to do with what you will, because that feels good. But yeah, in terms of not needing to have, and you know, I have subject specialty areas, but like at WSU it was engineering and biology, and at Reed it's religion and humanities and history. So I mean, it's not because I have this like great background in any of those things, it's because those are the disciplines that were like open and available. And I'm not expected to have deep subject knowledge. I'll probably develop it over time because how could you not? But you're not necessarily expected to have that. Now at some other institutions, you'll be hired as, you know, the political science librarian, and you're expected to have a master's degree in political science in addition to your master's degree in library science, and that's a totally different thing. But yeah, it's, I think a lot of people will tell you, you have to have a second master's degree, you have to have all this deep subject knowledge in another discipline, but it's not true in my experience. I know lots of people that don't have that at all and aren't great academic librarians, and yeah.
So I have a question for you, and I realize now that you're very new to your position, you might not know the answer.
That's fine.
But I came across a wiki 6 months or so ago by Reedies demanding that their theses be digitized.
And I know about that.
I was really, really curious about the institutional response to that.
Well, I'm only just now, it's so interesting, on Friday I had a conversation about this with Vicky, the director. Yeah, the students, the Reed has a really active Students for Free Culture chapter, and they're kind of folks that are interested in open source and copyright reform and that kind of stuff, and open access. And yeah, so one of the projects that this chapter has taken on is trying to get their theses digitized and have open access to them. And the institutional response is, I would say, I don't really know, so this might be wrong, but from what I've been able to tell, it's like, yeah, we'd like to do that, we've got to figure out.
So is that part of your job now? Is that part of your position?
I will probably be involved with that, you know, just because I have an interest, and I want to kind of like get in some kind of mentorship position with that chapter, because you know, that's kind of my issues. But I think, you know, from the library's perspective, and we'd be the ones that are doing it, it's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's figure out how to do it. I think I was able to pick up on a little, there's some, you know, faculty and some sort of alum pressure. There's some factions that don't think that's a good idea. And I have to say, having written an undergraduate thesis, I have a certain amount of sympathy with that. Like, if your thesis is like open and available, I mean, there's a certain sort of protection in doing that kind of scholarship at that level. I mean, because when you're just like a senior in undergraduate college, you're not really creating new knowledge.
I don't know.
For the most part, your theses are just an exercise in writing like a really big paper. And it's a really great, rewarding, it was like one of the best intellectual experiences of my life, writing my thesis. How glad am I that it only exists in a paper form and sits on the shelf in my college library and isn't even cataloged? Really glad, because I don't want people reading it because it's not very good. So I have a certain amount of sympathy for, and I think if I had felt all along anyone in the world is going to be able to read this thesis, it would have.
A lot of readies are required to do original research, though, especially in the science.
You're doing original research, but you're not necessarily creating new knowledge.
Married to a readie, so he would love to have this.
Yeah.
Because he did do original research, and nobody has access to the original research that he did. And
as
so
somebody who wrote a Reed thesis, though, I don't think I would be especially glad if everybody could read my thesis, because likewise, it wasn't very good. Maybe I got a C on it at Reed.
Oh, well, I mean, in mine, I got like the highest honors on. I mean, it was a great thesis. I mean, I'm very proud of it, but do I want it out there as part of my. And so I don't think that this is a. I think that this particular issue, the digitization of undergraduate theses, is a great lens through which to see the kind of open access debate, because you can really I usually like cannot sympathize in any way, shape, or form with the other side. You know, the let's keep it locked down, let's not make it available kind of. I'm like, fascist, you know, I don't sympathize with it at all. And so this, I can totally sympathize with the side that says, you know, maybe this, in some ways, you know, makes it dampens the scholarship. It's gonna make it less possible for them to explore new ideas, because they're gonna be feeling this pressure of it's gonna be out there, and I don't want to, like, as an undergraduate, put some crazy idea out there that then, you know, when I'm applying for a professorship at, you know, Harvard, somebody's gonna read my like insane idea that I had when I was, you know, when I was a kid. I have a lot of sympathy for that side. Now, I don't think it should stop the progress of open access at Reed, and I think that they'll probably find some way to opt in and opt out.
Kind of thing.
Okay. I guess, can someone explain to me what, I don't really understand the issue. What precludes these people from scanning their theses and publishing them themselves on the web?
They could.
So
it's
what
just
is
like
the
making
issue?
It available in the library for like other students to be able to access those.
And it, yeah, it makes it part of like the institution.
The school's responsibility to put their theses on.
Well, if it was part of the school website, it would be have more validity and truth, because I could publish anything I want on a website right now and say that it's a Reed thesis. I can put that those words on it. But if it's attached to the Reed website, that means it really is that thing.
And then the school
okay,
would have
so
responsibility
for
archiving
for
it and, you know, maintaining access to it as, you know, as technologies change.
Yeah.
I mean, I could put something up on my website and then stop maintaining my website, or technologies could change and I might not learn how to do that new technology, and then what, and my thesis wouldn't be available. So yeah, there's the validity, and then there's the sort of institutional memory, having all the theses together. Again, those that pleasure of context thing, all the theses together, you get a better picture of what is going on.
Is writing a thesis a graduate requirement of Reed?
Yes.
So we're talking about a real glut of theses.
There's a lot of theses, yes.
Yep.
I don't think there's a lot of talk about going back and doing old theses. This would be new theses. Yeah.
There's also, I saw there's a story in the New York Times recently, maybe other people saw, about how a lot of Hollywood studios are finding that actually keeping a digital record of a film is much more expensive than keeping just a standard analog or celluloid copy of it, and because technology's changed and,
right.
and so on, you've got to make it. So it's almost the same. I can see the same thing with this problem. You know, what if technology changes in the future, and also how long would they be required to hold on to these forever? You know, somebody writes a thesis this year, and then in 2040, they still got, you know, someone could still be able to look it up.
Right.
I mean, I can see kind
so
of both
these
sides
are these
of it.
Are this is kind of what's slowing it down. It's just a lot of these kind of all right what. How do we go about this, and what are the kind of long-term issues involved with, you know, saying we're going to create this archive?
Yeah.
So, but they have, you know, there's a digitization program going on at Reed right now that's grant-funded, and so they have Content DM, and so they have kind of the technology. They've got an investment and a long-term commitment to the technology that's necessary in order to kind of create the institutional repository for the theses. So I think now that that's in place, it'll be pretty easy. And I think what they'll ultimately do is have kind of an opt-in type situation. But I know that from the library side, that there's, you know, willingness and even enthusiasm to do it. Yeah. But that was a great question, and I love how it kind of brought up the kind of...
I wasn't trying to be a troublemaker.
No, it's great. Because I think you can kind of see, oh, there are actually dark sides, or, you know, at least something to the other side about providing, you know, complete access. Yeah.
In your interview process and in your resume, how much did you include your varied background that was outside the library?
A lot. Yeah, because I think that it... and I don't know if I'm right, but I think that it, maybe just because it's web stuff and people like want people to know how to do web stuff, I know that that kind of makes me sellable, so I include that. But yeah, I definitely, like, in my interview, you know, it came up and I mentioned that I had been in the community and traveled around. Because I think, you know, people want to, when they're interviewing you, they're interviewing to find out if they can stand you. And if you're interesting, and if you are going to be like a fun coworker, so I mean, yeah, be yourself, and you know, when you create your package, you know, to send into a job interview, look at each. I mean, this is what I did. Each job that I applied to, I really looked at my resume and like looked at the culture of the place that I was applying and tailored it. So okay, I'm applying to Reed. Well, I know some things about what Reed is like, and I can talk to some people who work at Reed and kind of find out how they're going to take different things and, you know, decide what to include based on that. You know, so, but yeah, I think it's good to include the stuff that you do outside of libraries, because it just shows that you have a lot of different talents and interests and stuff.
Yeah.
If you're kind of making a space choice about, do I include this library thing or do I include this, you know, wacky other thing that I did, probably you include the library thing. And of course, I didn't like, I was a waitress for 5 years. We're like, I didn't leave on there, but yeah.
I have a question. I think we might have to wrap it up soon. I should go back at 1:30. You host something called Coffee Night?
Yes.
And can students come to that?
Please come to that.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So Coffee Night is basically just like a monthly conversation group about copyright and free culture issues. And we meet at the bar and we have some drinks and talk about copyright. And usually I'll try to have somebody come to kind of start the conversation. So, you know, somebody's got a question about a particular copyright issue, or they've been confronted with a particular copyright issue, or they're incensed about, you know, some new copyright bill, and they'll come and they'll talk for like 5 minutes about it, and then that kind of gets the conversation rolling. And we've got, you know, it's really great because there's attorneys that come, and librarians, and artists, and podcasters, and pirate radio people, and open source developers, and occasionally, and this is exciting when it happens, you'll have like, you know, attorneys who are on the other side, you know, who want like more restrictive copyright law that will come, and then we can have some debates, and that's good. Usually, it can get a little samey, you know, we're all like, yeah, I agree, and yeah, I agree, but that's nice. you know, tattoo artists, a really varied group of people. And you get to see like how these different disciplines and professions and people with different interests perceive these issues, and really gets me outside of like my library only view on this stuff. And then a lot of times you'll share library issues, and it's a great opportunity to kind of educate the people at the table, because I had no idea that was happening in libraries, and see a little education about what libraries are like, which is fun. And yeah, I'm kind of trying, it was like a little sleepy there for a while because I was traveling a lot and super busy and just didn't do a lot of publicity and didn't arrange the speakers, but I'm kind of trying to revitalize it, so definitely come. we had a good group, some Emporia students last week when we had it, and next month we're going to be talking about digitization projects in libraries and the kind of copyright, crazy copyright issues that come up with that when you're like going through an archive and creating a digital repository of it. My colleague at Reed, who's doing that, is gonna kind of kick the conversation off. So I think it should be a really fascinating conversation, actually. And we have blog, copynightpdx.wordpress.com.
That's what we'll find out about the next meeting.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Whoa.
Walk the books. Yeah. Thank you for asking that. Let me have my pitch.